Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 246, my chat with Australian artists Asia Beck and Ben Snaith. But first, let's chat about our sponsors. Today's episode is sponsored by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You guys, taking long drives is how I am staying sane these days, and Audible is right there with me, helping to distract my mind from whatever stress I'm cooling off from. I've read novels, self-help books, poetry books, and recently, I listened to this recording of a live show with Common called Bluebird Memories. That was truly amazing. It felt like I was in the theater. I needed that. Audible is available on most of the devices in your home. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to download the app and sign up to get your free audiobook today. Maybe you need it too. Our other sponsor for today's episode is my company, PodcastCadet.com. My husband, Chris Jordan, and I run the company PodcastCadet.com. We provide advice and production help to anyone who needs it. We do one-on-one consultations. We have prefab videos to help with specific issues like what audio equipment to use or best practices for interviewing. We can give you a little push, or we can help you with the production of all of your episodes. Contact us now at podcastcadet.com and use code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. PodcastCadet.com, helping creators navigate the waters of podcasting. This week on Yes But Why, we chat with Australian improv duo Asia Beck and Ben Snaith. In our conversation, we talk about performing improv and building your own performance style. We talk about their recent duo show, Ben and Asia Have a Relationship, which they performed totally naked. Whoa. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 246, Asia Beck and Ben Snaith on vulnerability through improv. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah. My first question for you guys is, when you guys were little, were you always performing for your family? And, you know, if not, like, what was the first experience of performing where you were like, oh yeah, this is my jam?
I feel like I was pretty much always like putting on like magic shows for my family and their friends. And, you know, I have this memory of being like, extended family, you know, in interstate, and like for some reason doing like a recital of all these different dance styles that I actually had never trained in, but presented to this like family of uncles and aunties who I was only meeting for like the second or first time. And like I remember doing like Michael Flatley style like Lord of the Dance and and like just like ballet, and little styles of dance that, yeah, I didn't actually know. But they were all really nice about it. And then I guess all through like primary and high school, I was finding like little opportunities to get up on stage. And I think especially as like a teenager, I really fell in with like, being that sort of like, kind of like emotional teen who would be like writing poetry and writing songs and stuff in my room, like sort of fumbling around with a guitar. And so I guess like on that kind of level, I was just sort of really just loved doing it. But also, you know, my family was very much like, you know, well, it's like one in a million, you making a career out of it, you know, like there's no way of you doing that kind of thing. And I don't know, just like, you know, like dad just kind of being like, oh, yep, still singing, huh? Like, yeah, okay, well, you know.
Oh, man.
And so, like, I mean, it was, yeah, like it took a little while before my dad, especially, like, I remember when I was about 19 and that was starting to get a bit of cred around the city, and he came to one of those shows, and I remember, like, you know, there was this older person there who, I think, going up to my dad and being like, oh, your son is a genius. Like, and it was kind of, it took other people before my dad was like, oh, okay, well, this what he really does want to do, and it's not completely crazy, and, you know, I will support him then, you know, by showing up and not really ever giving any much feedback, or you know, even just being like, well, I was here. Yeah,
sometimes that's all you can ask for, right?
Yeah, that's all I need. Like, one of my bands, we had a dancing dad start dancing because it was mostly like live bootleg recordings, and during one of these, like this real wild show, the crowd like up, and I could see right at the back of the room, see my dad and his friend just standing there, and I was holding the microphone, and I was just like, start dancing, dad, start dancing. and yeah, that like came through really clearly in the recording, and it was really funny. And yeah, so I guess it's been this interesting path where I've like gradually become more and more confident with just being like, this is, I literally am this, like this is what I do, and this, I'm a performer and an artist, and I'm just like this. And you know, as I'm getting and stuff, all of my family and stuff, I'm just been less and less apologetic about it. Like, I used to be like, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm doing this thing, but I'm also studying, like, you know. But now I just am kind of like, no,
yeah,
gotta show on, shows on. Yeah,
I mean, once you make the decision for the lifestyle that you want to lead, like, your family can be like, oh, I don't understand that, and you're like, yeah, I know what you went through, so I can see why you don't, but that's fine. That's what I'm doing. It's all right.
It really took me moving to like a whole other state and another city to be able to find that sense of confidence. Like, I grew up where we are now. The state is called Queensland, and it's like this real, it's really big, but it's kind of like, from what I understand about America, it's kind of like Florida. Like, it's like beachy and like, you know, it sort of has a bit of a trashy vibe to it, like, and there's like gators if you go up north, and like, you know, it's, yeah, it's kind of a, I don't know, it's kind
of, is that
of like
why your stage name was Orlando Furious? You had like a real Florida vibe.
No, like Orlando Furious, no, that was like a it was about 8 years ago. I was having a drink with a friend, and he was a very literary guy. Like, he just knew heaps about old literature. And for some reason, he was just ranting to me about this old, like, 16th century Italian poem called Orlando Furioso. And the title character was just this, like, total wild card who just, you know, he, like, lost his wits at one point because the woman he loved eloped, and, like, his wits ended up on the moon, and his friend had to ride this, like, Gryffindor up to the moon to, like, get his wits back in a bottle. Wow. Insane story. And I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna take that, take that, like, final O off the end, so it's, like, not, like, an Italian thing so much.
That's way better than you being like, I went on a trip to Orlando, Florida, and I got real mad. And it was like, I'm
yeah, totally. Yeah. But it's been, it's been a really fun kind of like journey with doing that stuff. Like, I've toured pretty hard as like a solo kind of musician. Like, I used to describe what I did as sort of like a backyard Kanye. Like, it was kind of like big kids and big ego, but like sort of backyard and Australian, and like, you know, very suburban, like kind of very suburban, and like I don't know, like there was just a bit of cheese.
Kanye West won 70,000 votes in the recent election. Just so,
what?
I mean, legit. He's pretty legit.
Is that like 0.0 of the of a percent of the population?
Definitely. It's like the population of the smallest town. We're all like, let's do it. Yeah, let's do it.
I read somewhere that he like didn't get his like paperwork in on time.
I thought so too. That's why I was like, you know what though? People can write in whatever they want. So people could be, he doesn't have to put in his paperwork and people could have voted for him, so whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's like, more than I got.
It was a ridiculous amount. But hey, what I'm saying is Kanye is popular with certain people, just like you.
Totally. I mean, I sort of stopped. The reason why I say I used to do it was because when he went that kind of bit MAGA, like, I was a bit like, oh, I don't know if I'm aligning myself with this anymore. But it was such a good shorthand for explaining what I was doing. Like, it was like, oh, okay, now I understand. You're just going to be a bit of a weirdo and jump on the table, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Don't let him near couches and Oprah. It'll be terrible.
Exactly.
My goodness. So you mentioned something about when you were performing your music, you said that you were touring a lot, and you had mentioned we went down a bit of a rabbit hole talking about Queensland, but you said you lived in a different place and now you're
I mean,
you feel more yourself because you get to be in your own place.
Pretty much, yeah. I moved with a band, like say about, I don't know, 12 years ago now, down to a city called Melbourne, which is the New York of, like, it's where like a lot of the art and the music scene kind of is. And it's where, like, you know, it's very cool to be like just sort of dressed in black and, you know, you're very like, there's like a thriving theater scene and it's lovely. I love that city. And it was this awesome place to just kind of, you know, try heaps of stuff out. And like, you know, I treated it like pretty much one massive open mic night. You could play like heaps of different places. I found myself in this kind of underground theater scene as well. And like, you know, it was really formative to be able to see people who were kind of like further along in their artistic progression than I was. And, you know, have people to kind of look towards either for, you know, future inspiration or also as like, you know, cautionary tales, you know, of what not to do potentially. And so I was living there for about 8 or 9 years. And when I finished my teaching degree, I like moved back to Queensland just to try and get to know my family again, because I really had basically just been like, oh, I'm going to be an artist, and just basically abandoned them. And, you know, I had all this guilt about like leaving my sister. So I sort of moved back with the intention of getting to know them better. And it's kind of happened, but also I'm also now living about an hour away from them. So
an hour is a manageable amount though.
Yeah,
like it's like close enough that you can go. Yeah. Like you can go there, you can get there if you need to, but you don't have to.
Like this show, no, it was surprising because my family members came, like, which is bizarre, absolutely bizarre. But none of Ben's family, I think, would be able to handle the material at all, like in any way. I think they'd have to walk. I think they wouldn't be able to handle being in the whole show, like watching the whole show.
I don't think I could invite anyone except for my mother to any improv, never mind naked improv.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my mom just sits there and smiles and goes like, very nice. So, I mean, who knows what she really thinks, but my sister would never sit through it. She'd be like, right. What? And she'd leave immediately, you know?
Wow.
Like, it's just not her scene, you know, not in a mean way, not in a like, oh God, who are these terrible people? But just like, I'm going to just hang out front and I'll see you after. Like, you know, it's not their scene, you know?
As much as I might try and drag them to certain stuff, or like, you know, if I made it clear that it was really important, but I kind of knew that when we were devising this show and when we made the decision to go naked for it, I was like, well, that pretty much, like, you know, my dad, my mom, and my sister are probably not going to come to this. But that was totally fine because they weren't really the audience that we were, you know, aiming for. Right.
With my family, I'm kind of like, no, this is just not your thing at all. So I don't want anybody at the show who's just going to be there because for no reason. Like, I just don't like that at all. Like, yeah, so do you ever sort of feel like when your dad does come, it's like, ugh, why are you even here?
That's how it is now. Like, there was a show that I played in Adelaide one time with my music act, and Adelaide is like in a completely other city again. And my dad just happened to be staying there for a while because he was working, and we went out for dinner beforehand, and he ended up getting like really drunk with some of his friends. And then it led to like when I finally went on at around 11 o'clock or whatever, Dad sort of had come in and was like standing next to the speaker, like bobbing his head and stuff. And I was like, whoa, my dad's here. Like, and the crowd was all like, crazy. And that was actually really lovely. Yeah, that was actually, So that was nice. But
nice. I've never seen him bob his head, like, ever.
I mean, they're not all dads are into bobbing heads. Plus, right. Think about how much older he is than me. Bobbing his head can hurt him. You don't know. You could be like, ow, 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 ow. It's just like not a good,
Oh, I'm telling you.
Not all the parts work. Dads would love to nod. There's whole Facebook groups. Dads who wish they could nod. Like, it's like all subculture.
Finest views together.
So Asia, tell me a little bit about your beginnings. What was the first, you know, performance stuff that you got into? Was it early in life or was it later?
We could just talk about Ben on this thing, you know, like we could just do that. We could totally do that.
Did you have a traumatic first performance? Was it really terrible?
It's more like the general upbringing was kind of traumatic, and from what I understand, sorry Asia, but it seems like performance is like the thing that has been the light.
Yeah, it has been really cathartic. The performance itself has been really cathartic for me. Always, hands down, always. I would like to stay in the performance space and just live there forever and just not ever be in the real world because it's so transportive for me, performing is, that it's so much more comfortable than being in real life. It's funny because yesterday I did an audition to get into my master's, which at the end of the day, the head of master's of Bachelor of Music or master's of music is an old teacher of mine that I went to from when I was about 10 or 11. And it was just bizarre because I haven't performed in over 10 years. And this show was like the first show that had actually ever done a public performance. It's been more than 10 years actually since I've performed publicly. But then she just sort of she said it a couple of times. She's like, oh yeah, because Ben was in the room. Ben is officially my carer, and my bass player Ruben was in the room too. And she goes, yeah, because you know she was a child prodigy. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I just don't see myself in that light at all. And I was made to perform from a very young age. So I guess...
It's kind of like you're a child prodigy because you were essentially whipped into performing.
But I think even before they knew I could sing... and perform, and before they knew I could captivate people's attention, I knew that I could hear things that other people couldn't hear. And I could understand emotions that other people were a little bit blunt to. I remember, I have memories from when I was, you know, three, remembering sounds and tone patterns and the deep feelings associated with sound, that was there before anyone could beat me into anything, you know. So it's been and when they say, you know, gifted, it's a gift, but it's a curse as well when you have to live in society, and you're sort of bent against other people's control and will. And they'll do what they want with you because you're just a child. But yeah, it's I guess I don't know. Where do I even begin? It's it's a long story. But does that give you a bit more? That's terrible.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you don't ever have to talk about anything that makes you uncomfortable at all. It's a door into how it got started for you. But the idea that it got started for you and was tarnished by yucky adults trying to get their, you know, trying to get cash payment for it or whatnot, notoriety, that,
like religious
that
gratification. Yeah.
So I grew up in what is a religious, was until the cult leader died, in a religious cult, and they were extreme for what some people would classify the extreme sort of churches, and it was fundamental Christianity, but like we had a prophet. And Jesus was going to come back every Wednesday. We were supposed to wait for him, you know. And then if it didn't happen that week, it was going to happen the next week or the next week, you know. And we had tin beans in the cupboard, and we had bottled water and, you know, gallons of water, and we lived on acreage and we had a farm and stuff because my parents had given up on education and taken us out and quote-unquote homeschooled us while they worked full-time. But we were essentially just going out under a tree and waiting for Jesus to come back. And in the process, because they knew I could sing and I had a gift for communicating musically. There was a lot of like salvation to be made, and other people brought into the fold. To become sheep,
sure.
which is something I'm really not proud of at all. I don't like the judgment. I don't like what everything I was taught to represent and everything that I ended up believing quite vehemently. Just as a child, as a kid, and just taunting and sort of holding harsh judgment about other humans. Just very, very harsh judgment, but being so swept up by music, just music itself. It can be any kind of music, you know, and you can get something profound out of it. They used it for their own, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
No, absolutely. I totally get what you're saying. I mean, there are, what you're talking about makes me think of some of the like child actors or child pop stars that I'm aware of whose parents like took their money and then like spent it all. And then like they're adults and they literally were the most like, somebody was just talking about like Britney Spears. Like Britney Spears has nothing right now. And she like has like legal documents where she can't actually even perform without like, or like go on dates without her parents' like permission. And she's legit in her mid 30s, if not early 40s. Like, that's super weird. So like,
how did they manage
I just
that?
Heard about that. You know, I feel like once you become a celebrity, then the idea of that is your agency is taken away from you because like you're a commodity. And so you're commodification means that you don't have the same rights as other people. And so the people who make money off of you can do what they want. And it happens to lots of people. You know, I'm sure that like there's plenty of, you know, celebrities we look at and are like, oh man, they must be so happy. And really they're just like signing checks all day being like, I wish I could do anything else. Like, who knows, you know?
And so, I mean, the cult of celebrity, you know, and the, and like, you know, more what we would just describe as cults, like there's such an overlap between, you know, like especially what I imagine for like a child to be raised in, you know, a sort of a very like sectioned off little rigid community that, you know, was so rigid and so intense kind of thing. Like I feel like the same sort of mania exists around celebrity culture as it does within like these sort of small little like communities that are secluded on these little properties and you don't even know what's going on there kind of thing. I guess at least in celebrity culture there's a semblance of accountability because the media is so willing to just be like, oh, Britney Spears, blah, blah. You know, like they're willing to bring so much light to it kind of thing. But yeah, I think it's so crazy in like the, you know, to just have my eyes open in recent times to just the sheer amount of really intense religious cults that are existing just in our, you know, like Asia grew, like that was happening sort of 50 kilometers from where I was growing up, you know, in this kind of normal, you know, quote unquote normal sort of suburban-y. It's been kind of like intense and
yeah,
to understand the depths of the control that was going on, like, and manipulation. Yeah, it's been really intense.
But, hard too that they took away the joy of music from you, you know, that they made it perfunctory for their purposes and then it sort of lost the luster and the beauty that it had for you. How, Asia, did you, I mean, clearly you found your way out of that cult, I guess, thankfully, because the guy passed away. I'm not sure how I feel about all that. And also the whole experience of everything you went through. But as you got older, did you, what was the experience that allowed you to get back into it? I imagine, rightfully so, that you would be like, no, thank you. I won't be singing or performing anymore. And I get that, but now you're performing again. How did you get back into it?
Well, I've had, I spent a bit of time escaping the cult even before the leader was dead. I got married to get out and get away from my family. And married somebody else who was from a similar ideology, so it was acceptable. But had a major mental breakdown in the process and realized after being hospitalized for, you know, 12 months and then, you know, in and out of hospital. But I realized, or they realized, the doctors did, who got me off a bridge and you know, essentially rescued me on one level, that I was suffering from a disease, really. And I just spent a lot of time trying to survive and trying to find, because I'd left my family and I'd essentially, oh God, I'd fallen through the cracks well and truly. But one thing that I had begged my parents, when I was 16 to let me go back to school. So because musically I was gifted and I could read music somehow, and I still ended up getting high school education, and then I ended up going to university and doing Bachelor of Music back when I was still 18, 19, 20, and finished that off when I was married. But I was very unbalanced. And everybody would just put it down to sort of the devil, the devil's tempting you to whatever, which sure. was not helpful at all. How did I get back into it? I don't really know. I went to, there's always been this thing where I'm like, I know that I love this. I know that I want this. I like to perform. I like to create things. And I was just, I was only in my 20s and I was already, but there was something inside of me that was like, make something. So I went to improv theater classes. And I met Ben there, and thankfully I was off medication that was, medication is imperfect at the best of times. I'm not a huge advocate either way for being off or on medication when you have a serious that distorts your idea of reality. I just think it's hard. Life is really hard, if you don't have a logical mind to navigate safety, it's just been a disaster. Somehow I got myself to improvise classes, and I met an amazing community of supportive people and was able to sort of fake being relatively normal. and then just finding the right people. I've heard it said before, in other interviews that, it's, you just got to meet the right people. And it sounds stupid and simple, but it's really true. I met Ben, and then soon after we were dating, and we just fell into a routine that, where we were creating stuff just all the time. And it's been, how long has it been? It's not been that long.
No, it's only been a little bit over a year. We met in idiot improv class with the theatre that we work with here called Big Fork Theatre. And they're like made up by these amazing group of directors who, I guess when they all started, they all met by going over to like train at the Improv Olympic and in Chicago. And they like had all this sort of experience with like, really wanting to follow the path of like Del Close, like, the truth in comedy kind of long form improv style.
Interesting.
And we just like, I know for myself, I went to the foundations class and I was like hooked. And then before you know it, I'm going through the intermediate classes. It's kind of like, sort of a wild element to the class, because she would just sort of come in and be this like sort of just an energy that you couldn't really pick, you couldn't like just immediately put your finger on it. And And she came to me with the idea of us starting like a little sketch group with some of other people who were also in the class. And so, you know, we started meeting on Sundays and trying to write sketches and trying to figure out how to, you know, try and figure out our own little path of improvising. And, you know, and from there, like that was around when we started dating. And like we just... Yeah, like Asia said, we, you know, we've worked on like music videos together for the Orlando Furious project, and like we've, you know, just formed a lot with Big Fork Theatre together, and and the, yeah, and then this show that we've just kind of been devising for the past 8 weeks, like that was us, like, you know, just trying to. There's been a couple of the directors that have been off doing like duo shows lately, and we were like, ah, duo, you can just do it with two people, you know, and like being in lockdown and stuff with the coronavirus, you know, you've, well, it is literally just the two of us here, like, you know, we're gonna have to just do it on our own. And yeah, and so we started kind of figuring out what, you know, what we could kind of get towards. And the more that we were sort of jamming on, like, you know, working out little scenes together and stuff, like figuring out how we would do it, the more we wanted it to be sort of blurring the lines of reality and being, leaning into being vulnerable about our, like me with my anxiety and, you know, and depression and all of that sort of stuff, and Asia with her schizophrenia and her background and stuff. And we wanted to, you know, recently Asia was on a, like a improvise, like a people of color improvisers, like panel, you know, this discussion that was on, it was like a Zoom stream kind of thing. And on that, like, you know, they were talking, there was a big message of like feeling of people of color in our improv community feeling like if they were to make reference to their background, that, you know, the people who were kind of, they were more likely to get wiped, you know what I mean? Like they were more likely if they, because there were all those concerns about like, oh, you know, don't, what is this racism? Are we being like, what is the, you know, when say like an Indian improviser would to put on an Indian accent, you know, like a more Indian accent, for instance, you know, they were talking about this feeling of wanting to explore these kind of cultural ideas, but feeling silenced and stuff. And so when we started devising our show, it was very much like we weren't going to really have the option to wipe kind of thing. It was essentially going to be like an hour, essentially a mono scene kind of thing. But then we gradually kind of tweaked the format over time as we were rehearsing it. But yeah, it's been a really interesting journey this past like year or so. Like I feel like I've only been studying and performing improv for, yeah, it must be about 18 months, because I would have met Asia at sort of the sixth, you know, like a few months in. And
wow. Yeah. So you guys created this show. You said you're working with directors. What's the style, like, is it sketch in that you've written stuff ahead of time, or are you doing improv with a form like Harold but not Harold?
So I guess the way that we thought about it was we lacked this idea of exploring a relationship, you know, like an intimate relationship, and, you know, the stages of a relationship, you know, like, you know, maybe one scene could be like when this couple first met, but like maybe the next scene could be when this couple is like in their 60s, or you know what I mean, like they're we wanted it to be essentially the initial idea was that it was like four stages, like, and they could be in order, out of order, whatever, like one of us would just kind of make the offer and we would make it clear like where we were, when we were in the context of our relationship, what had sort of changed, what had evolved, what, you know, And yeah, and it was basically, it would be kind of 4 15-minute scenes essentially, that we just, so we would just start doing these kind of jams to like a 15-minute timer where we would just play out like a, you know, essentially be Ben and Asia, but, you know, just kind of
an abstraction of,
yeah, a bit of an abstraction
past, of present, like, and future.
Yeah, and like bringing in things that might have occurred in like previous relationships, you know, and sort of kind of mining those like reflections for content for this. The way that it's kind of ended up, it has been basically, to give you just like an idea of what our show had the, for the past 3 nights has been, basically we come out, we have our friend Ruben playing an upright bass, and he's, so he's pro, kind of giving the jazz, the time, the, you know, this, the sense of gravitas that a big double brings. Completely, you know, black curtains, black floor kind of thing, and just a couple of spotlights. And then we've just like turned on the lights and gone like, you know, we're doing this thing on intimate relationships. We just want to sort of start a little discussion about any sort of patterns that you might have seen emerge in an intimate relationship over your life. You know, like what's something that is a reason why the relationship fails or why it succeeds kind of thing. And we've had these little discussions with the audience just to kind of flesh out the idea. And we've sort of let that sit within ourselves. And then we've hit the play button on the William Tell overture. And we had this like choreographed dance to that that basically culminated in like the ugliest strip scene where like we're just getting dragged by the shoe around the stage and stuff, and like it's just kind of ridiculous and silly, and it was a really nice way to kind of just warm the audience into the nudity, because you know we knew we were leaning into vulnerability, and I guess that's the ultimate in being really vulnerable on stage as opposed to just improvising for an hour, just you and another person, you know, is to be completely naked. And
wait, say that again. You chose to be naked because it's like the ultimate vulnerability?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, I know, like for myself, it was a, you know, I would have been comfortable just with underwear, you know, and but then it was just kind of like, no, like, because literally with this content that we're trying to like sift through, I guess, in this context, yeah, we needed to be naked. We had to be just completely naked and just be like, well, here, this is who we are. This is ourselves. This is us kind of thing. And that was kind of how I got to it. Like, I know Asia got to, she was really pushing that idea from a different perspective. And yeah, but that was kind of where we ended up with it. Okay, we're going to do this big, silly way of getting completely naked in front of the audience. And then basically just kind of pop a moment in this relationship, you know, and the dynamic is kind of, you know, developed. And then, I guess the way that the show would kind of go from there is after maybe that scene went on for about 10, 12 minutes or so, we would just kind of like melt down. And we would sort of give ourselves a break from improvising by Asia would do like a song with the double bass in accompaniment, and that would just be sort of a jazz standard kind of song. Mm-hmm. So it was really beautiful having these kind of contrasts of like these improvising scenes then with a and then with these like beautiful like jazz singing, you know, kind of moments, and like for that time special golden gloves to kind of signal, you know, this was like a, you know, a single spotlight kind of moment kind of thing for her. And so there was about two scenes of that, and then we decided on the third scene being like a primordial, like a caveman scene, like where we had to really physicalize
the kind of underlying, I guess, themes or vibes that had been brought up. And that was like really insane. Like some of those got really wild where we were like sort of screaming at each other or like, you know, or
grunting.
They were in these like really strange, like slow dances together and stuff. Like it was, yeah, some of the responses that we got were just like, Jesus, that was like, I have not seen anything like that. Like, and that came more from my like physical theater training, I suppose, like wanting to find that a bit more. And yeah, and then the final scene was us just kind of emerging, having like just gone through a massive journey together. We wanted a happy ending, just because we found in some rehearsals when we didn't have that rule, the parallel version of our relationship would like break up, and it was then we would just at home have like 2 days of just kind of aftercare and try and reassure the other one that sad. Like we weren't leaving.
You guys talk about the group that you started doing improv with as being you know, focused on Chicago style improv. This sounds a little bit more serious than that. Less jokey jokey, let's do fun time Harold play, and more like deep dive into emotional stuff. Do you have a coach or a director that like led you through that, or was that just the two of you working together?
I think, you know, we were starting and we really don't have, you know, we're quite connected to our community. So we invited a host of different people from either the physical theatre community or the improvisation community. But a lot of it was just self-worked stuff.
Totally was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we just kind of would ask, like, whoever we got to come along to a rehearsal, we would just... we would sort of ask them the specific questions that we wanted answered as the person sort of looking in, you know? Yeah. And we were really deliberate about who we chose. Like we knew that like within Big Fork, like there are people who probably are going to be like, where's the jokes, guys? You know, where's the bits? And like, but there's also other people who are like really, really receptive to it and really, you know, like we were really happy that like on, you know, Tuesday night, like all of the directors came to that show and they were all really supportive. I'm so glad to be a part of this like community of people.
Yeah. Surprisingly, they were impressed. they were, you know, it isn't what our theater company is focused on at the moment, you know, the deep expression of sickness or separation or the anxieties of love, our humanity, the depths of our humanity. And that's not the focus of the theater group we've come from. But
they do appreciate risks. Like they appreciate you like taking a, and you know what, we have that really big thing of like before every show, you know, it's always about like getting each other's backs and stuff, you know, so having
and
that trust and just being like, whoa, okay, you can do it, it's allowed.
That was certainly something that we almost had to relearn. So the fundamentals that we were taught from our theater school were completely invaluable, because once you think you have it, like we had to remind each other, you know, this is not, we have to trust, and there's so many layers of trust, you know, and to say, I have your back, I'm here for you, I'm here to help you create the scene. Oh, there's so much of yourself sometimes when you're working scenes through continuously. There's so much of yourself that you have to put away if you truly, truly want to be supportive of your acting partner, you know?
So you guys are, you developed this show and you put it up. Kudos doing that during COVID, though is Australia good?
Yeah, it's crazy how, like, I don't know how much you know about Australia and sort of Australian identity, but like, it's kind of a trip how there's a mainstream element of Australia that really prides itself on being like the larrikin, like the outlaw, you know, one of our like national icons is Ned Kelly, like the bush ranger who like shot at the police and stuff, like, you know, big like kind of energy on that. But at the same time, I think that, like, you know, Europe, like white Australia was founded on like convicts, you know. We were like, white Australians were like basically prisoners for, you know, the first like big chunk of time in, you know, as far as European history of Australia is concerned. And that has, I think that has trickled down into the way that we responded to COVID, where when all of our leaders, like, you are staying home and you are not doing anything, we were like, okay, yes, boss. And like, yeah. And we totally, yeah, like in Queensland, you know, they like locked the borders hard when there were other flare-ups in other parts of the country. And, you know, and everyone was just like, oh, great, we have such a strong leader who will, like, who will do that. And it's like, yeah, so we've definitely appreciated the benefits of it because, yeah, like, we, you know, we literally performed a show last night in front of, like, 40 people in, you know, in a theatre that, like...
That's great.
Yeah. It's mind blowing. Like,
I don't know the next time, know, I'll be able to get into a theater. You know,
I know. Like, it's, yeah, it's really intense. Like, and you know, it's like, even when like Melbourne had the most like draconian lockdown, you know, in the, I don't know if it was in the world or whatever, but it was this extended period of time. And so I knew for myself, like, putting on shows up in Queensland, being like, I'm not really going to promote this on my social media because I don't want to be an asshole to my like Melbourne friends who are like, you know, I know, are locked down and just sort of being like, you know, it's, yeah, it's really tricky, but yeah, definitely feel pretty lucky. Like, yeah. Like,
can I just say that when you were telling the story about the national identity of Australians, I really thought you were going to go the other way. Like, you were like, we really love this guy who shoots at cops. We're from, we're from prisoners. I thought you were going to be like, and then they were like, here's a rule. And you were like, we don't care about rules. No.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I really thought you were going to say. And I was like, oh, yeah, us too. We're all the weird people who were like, yeah, I'll get on a boat, or like, what's a boat? Oh, no, I'm on a boat. And then that's who's America.
Yeah.
I always talk about that. I'm like, what do you think this country was born on? The freaks, totally, who were like, I got to get out of Europe. Oh, yeah, get me out of here.
Definitely.
What? A 4-week boat trip? Yeah, better than my life. Let's go.
Like,
that's not really the crowd we want to have as our ancestors, is it? But it is.
So it's like, it's definitely gotten somewhere, you know, like, and that, it totally is true. Like, when we see America, you know, that's like commitment to freedoms there. Like, you know, you're, that's like on the individual level, just being like, nope, I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. Kind of vibe. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, you know, I'm not going to argue with it. Like, your whole, like, everything, it seems, was kind of built on this idea of the individual kind of thing. You know, I feel like I'm learning so much about this city, Brisbane, where we are now. And, you know, the, like, kind of convict settlement here was, like, just so brutal. Like, the people were just, like, beaten into submission.
It was,
like,
it was,
they,
awful.
You know, it's a... Yeah, like, it's a different kind of vibe, I think. Like, you know, it wasn't until sort of like 60 years on that people actually did start coming here for pleasure, you know what I mean? Like, as in white people coming to this country for, like, oh, yeah, I'll come and, you know, see what's up over there. You know, for the most part, it was just like, no, you are going to hell. Like, you are going on a however many month boat ride to, you know, somewhere where
it would have taken ages.
Yeah.
No,
it was like 7 or 8 months.
I cannot, you know how when people say things like, hey, if you could go to another time in history, when would you go? I'm always like, no.
No.
I'm good. Like, no. I have science and airplanes and rights. I feel good. Like, I'm not going back. No, thank you.
And I mean, like, yeah, those people who are like, oh, yeah, I'd go back to 60s for the music or whatever. But like, yeah, we have the music.
it exists with us now. So
yeah, we've got it.
If that's all you're going back for.
Yeah, if you want to reflect on the political strife of the 60s, just keep watching US News. You'll find it. It's fine. Yeah. It's available.
It hasn't gone anywhere.
We're here for you. Write some folk songs about us, and there you go. There we go. We got
finished.
It.
Finished. Exactly. Done.
The 60s. Yeah. We're here again.
Yeah, completely. Crazy.
I'm glad that you guys were able to have your show and that you're able to continue to do stuff. Is the improv theater back in full swing as well?
Pretty much.
Yeah, like, I mean, now they've broken up for Christmas.
Sure.
But they, they were the ones who sort of dipped their toes back out, and you know, for a little while there it was like they're like Big Fork Friday shows, which like I used to just love. Like, we used to just cram like as many people as we can into them. Was down to sort of like 20 people were allowed in the room, and you know, you had a cast of like 5. And then I'm pretty sure it didn't get, I think it might have gotten up to like 30 people were allowed maybe by the end of the year. Because it was it's a pretty small theater space where there were. And so it's just kind of slowly but surely, like, when we locked down, and I was so grateful that like the Big Fork people went on to Zoom, like stream to YouTube shows, like, and jams and training and stuff, like, pretty much immediately. And you know, I know for myself, I just got like right on that, like, because myself being like a really former, like, it was such a challenge just sort of sitting in the chair and like listening and like trying to just build the relationships and respond and all of that sort of stuff. And like, I loved even just like playing with the webcam camera. Like, I'd lift up the laptop and like swing it around and like bring it to and forward, like, for dynamicism. And it was like, yeah, just to kind of keep going and keep working, and knowing that, you know, a handful of people were watching on the live stream to YouTube kind of thing was, you know, kind of all I needed.
Yeah. The Zoom explosion is wild, and the international improv connection that has happened. I mean, like we were talking about earlier, Asia, I think you and I met on a Facebook group for international improvisers, and it was like, wild group. And like, how did we ever speak to one another? And then
find us? Like,
the beauty of it is that, you know, where the world got a little bit smaller when everyone had to be on Zoom, and theaters have taken the harshest hit of anybody. So they're like, yeah, we're artists. We're good. We're going to reinvent the entire thing. And now like every day at every hour of the day, you could probably find an improv jam just in a different country. Like, you're like, it's a little late tonight here in Texas, but what time is it in India? Because maybe they got something going on, right? So there's like whole big groups that you can connect to now, and it's just so beautiful that it exists and that we can all connect to one another. So my focus is usually on the positive, as far as like, this is a rough time, but like I've been connected to other improvisers in such a wide swath that it's like, I'm so excited and so happy to be connected with all of you and everyone, and all the international communities that now I just happen to be like chatting with every day and like seeing on Zoom occasionally. And it's like, what?
I love it. Yeah, it's awesome. And yeah, you literally, I think you're exactly right that, you know, when things just kind of appear, like problems kind of appear, there are the, like, to have these kind of positives come out of it. Like, you know, we knew for ourselves, like learning from the Bigfoot directors about how crucial it was that we got across to the Improv Olympic, you know, and trained in Chicago and stuff, like to then be like, whoa, these guys are running like online jams, like we can get in on that, you know. I think they might have closed down now, but
I was like, I don't know how IO is handling the whole thing. I don't even know how Chicago's handling it right now, but it's very interesting that the whole theater was born from IO and the sort of Del Close style, because, you know, I don't catch that a lot in other countries. Most people are not focused on that kind of thing, but hey, it's so super cool. And I love the idea that these guys were so inspired. They like went on a trip and then came back and were like, guys, let me tell you, like that's the best. Like improv evangelists are my favorite.
Yeah, that's, you know, for us, like I remember when like one of the directors, Jim, he could tell that I was like really soaking everything up and stuff, and he was like, oh, we got a theorist here, we got like, so he like quickly got me The Truth in Comedy, and like I went away and like devoured that, and you know, it's been so lucky, news, and the people have been here in like, you know, what is a pretty small city, you know, and there's this community here where people are like, yeah, hell yeah, like, come on, Del Close.
Hey man, from what I hear from people who met him back in the day, he was, you know, engaging in a way that nobody was, you know, like some people are just draw you to them and, you know, have a vibe that everyone wants to be part of. And, you know, this guy was it. So they burn hot and they burn fast and then they're gone. And it's like, wow. What happened? But, you know, I've talked to a bunch of people. I've talked to improvisers of all ages, and it's always interesting to be like, wait, you took a class with Del Close? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, now we need to get into that. Like, I know that you're like famous for various other things, but this is what I want to talk about. And it's also fun too to talk to you guys about stuff, because like that's the same style that I was trained in as well, right? Yeah. So it's like, oh wow, we're more connected than I thought, you know. And not to say that like I would ever do the kind of show that you guys did. You guys are, your show about vulnerability and performing naked as a choice is such an intense and amazing choice, and clearly born out of the, you know, deep artists that both of you are, which is really great. I'm glad that you have each other, because like you can like inspire each other and create these projects. That's so awesome. My final question to you guys is to ask about, you know, what advice do you have for other improvisers, maybe right now in the world, that are trying to create, like, what, how do you like tap into creating your own show, whether it be able to be in front of people or online? Like right now, such a crazy time. How did you tap into creating this when the world was like so insane?
I think one, I feel as though it's like looking inside, like looking into the relationships. Like I guess I'm learning where I'm at with improv at the moment is just like everything is about the relationship that you're building with your, you know, with the other character in the space, you know? And so I guess
just like really zoning in on that and finding like the truth in the connection between those two characters, even if they're like totally really big, goofy, silly characters kind of thing, finding that.
Yeah. Or even if they're the opposite of that.
Mm. And then as far as like getting a show up, like, you know, I think that, I mean, all I feel like we could say is to just like, you know, put the timer on, like do it for, see how it feels to actually just go for an hour and then be like, okay, well, what if we added a bit of structure to that so that there was some, you know, some ups and downs that, you know, we're already sort of there that we can then bounce off against, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like just sort of feeling the time itself, like feels like a really important thing as far as just kind of understanding the nature of a show. And then the final thing that I would say would be just like watching as much improv as possible, you know? Mm. Yeah.
Like Bennett absorbs so much, and you know, on an intellectual level, and I think why we come together so well is because I'm very, I don't know, just bluntly practical. I would say, you know, you're sort of saying, you know, at a time like this, and maybe we haven't sort of struggled with COVID as much as America is unfortunately struggling right now. But I'm always glass half full, you know. It's always half full. The world's always had problems and epidemics, and there's always going to be a boogeyman waiting to get you. Always. It's just inevitable. But if you're just going to see the world and see your insecurities and see failure, then you might as well not get out of bed. And so book the hall, you know, or book the time. You know, you gotta be ballsy about it, and then book the times in. When you're gonna rehearse, when you're gonna do it. All right, we're gonna do it at this time every week. You know, for the next 10 weeks, and then we perform on this date. You know, just dive in head first, and sometimes, you know, you'll end up diving in and underestimating how shallow the water is and breaking your neck, you know, and becoming a quadriplegic. It could be disastrous. everything that can go wrong could go wrong, absolutely. But then, you know, it could flip the other way completely. Don't be one of those, like, oh, pussy-faced people. I'm going to get on my soapbox now. But that's just like, no, well, I don't know, you know. And then all of a sudden, it's 2 months later and you're still going, oh, I don't know. Because what's the point? Yeah. You know, make those bold decisions. Make those bold moves. Because who knows? I mean, the world could go up in flames tomorrow, and then
what? Or next Wednesday.
Or next Wednesday. that's how I live my life. Flames. So, as much as our process, I think, for putting on, for embodying a show from beginning to end is very different. But Ben, you seem to, you think of structure in the actual show, but like at the end of the day, I just think it's optimism and commitment to each other, to yourself, to the world around us, you know?
And this is, I feel like these are really big there. Answers to this like, yeah. wrap-up
no,
question.
No, they're great.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just feel like, you know, there'd be some people, like, we haven't been improvising for very long at all. You don't have to wait 10 years to do this stuff.
Exactly.
And it was totally. A successful show. It was, you know, we sold out on two nights, and, you know, the third night was full. You can't, as much as refining craft is important and doing it with respect to the elder gods of comedy. It still is a matter of just doing it. There's not enough bravery. I find there's a little bit of timidity amongst peers sometimes, and they don't just get out there and do it. And I'm just saying, and that's not a negative judgment on them. It's just like, come on, guys, you can do it. You can do anything. You can have anything you want. You know, you just got to try.
Can I just say that the phrase "elder gods of comedy" has really like gotten me going? Like in my head, I'm imagining like these huge like Greek god looking like statues, but like they're sitting on like whoopee cushions. And, like,
yeah, you know? Yes, they're smoking weed and.
And, it's like two statues are high-fiving each other. You're like, what's happening? Like, oh my God, that's so funny. No, these are great answers. No, I really, this is excellent advice. Both of you from your own points of view, how to get it done. And you talked about it, you know. Also, I think it's an excellent point Asia's making that like, you guys haven't been doing it that often yet. You were like, I want to make a show. So you did it. That the action is doing it, getting it done.
Totally.
Right? People aren't in improv because they're like, let's plan a lot of stuff kind of people. They're actually, right? You want to plan a lot of stuff? Write a play, get a play produced. That'll take you multiple years if you'd like to wait. Like, but you know, if you want to do something fast, improv is the way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you guys so much. Thank you, Ben and Asia, for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you guys taking time out of your day to talk to me and share your stories. It has been really great to talk to you and to hear what's going on.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. And thanks so much for having us.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.